Today is Thursday, January 18th. We're going to be working on more endocrine system information today. All right, so today we're going to get back into the thyroid gland. That's going to be from page 9 in your course pack. We'll just start from the beginning. I know we talked a little bit about this in class on Tuesday, but it's worth going back, just hitting it one more time. We know the thyroid gland is a butterfly-shaped gland found where? The neck, good, right around the trachea. I want to make sure we clarify that because the thymus is over the heart and the chest cavity, and sometimes those two do get confused. But of course, yeah, thyroid is in the neck around the trachea. On the back side, there's about 4 to 8 nodules of tissue. They're called the what glands?
Parathyroid,
good. In addition to regulating metabolism, what other hormone is produced by the thyroid gland?
Calcitonin,
good. And that regulates calcium levels in the bloodstream. So it's kind of interesting that the parathyroid also regulates calcium levels, and the hormone produced by that set of glands works antagonistic to calcitonin. So we'll kind of see how those two work together. We know that thyroid hormones like thyroxine can be stored in the thyroid gland. What's the name of that gel-like substance where it's stored?
Colloid,
good, good. About how long can we store it?
9 days.
Good, okay. And the name of the cells that make calcitonin in the thyroid gland?
Parafollicle,
good. So the thyroid hormones are actually two major hormones. We've got thyroxine and we've got triiodothyronine. We can call thyroxine T4 and triiodothyronine T3. What do the 4 and the 3 tell us? Good. How many iodine atoms? That's right. So they differ by one iodine atom. In fact, when we see the conversion of T4 to T3 at the site of our cells, all we do is drop off one of those iodine atoms, and then we've got T3, which is a more potent form of the thyroid hormones. So what we mean by a more potent form is that T3 is a stronger hormone, and it takes less of it to do the job of regulating metabolism. About 80% of your thyroid hormones are thyroxine, and about 20% produced by the thyroid glands are T3. But, you know, T3 is really the more powerful one at the site of your cells. We know that thyroxine is an oddball. It does not work as it should. It is a protein-based hormone. You would expect it to work by what system?
Second messenger,
right. But because it's an exception to the rule, it actually behaves like a steroid and instead arouses its target cells by what method?
Direct gene,
good. So let's focus on thyroxine for just a moment and T3. We know these hormones are controlled ultimately by the hypothalamus. And since they're controlled by other hormones, would you consider this to be humoral or hormonal stimulation? It's hormonal, good. So the ultimate control starts with the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus releases TRH. What does TRH target? Yeah, anterior pituitary. It in turn tells the anterior to release TSH. That's a stimulating hormone that travels to the thyroid gland and turns on release of thyroxine. Okay, so this is a classic negative feedback loop. Okay, and of course, the control mechanism here is regulated by your basal metabolic rate, your BMR. So the main job of thyroxine is to control metabolism and how fast your chemical reactions run in your body. And another important feature of thyroxine is to help with development. And like I talked on Tuesday, I'm very careful not to say the word growth because that's the responsibility of which hormone? Growth hormone, yes. So we'll leave the word growth out of our conversation here, and instead we'll focus on the development of the body. Okay, so we talked a little bit about this in class on Thursday. We know that thyroglobulin is a protein that escorts or transports thyroxine throughout the bloodstream. So we think of it as an important way to deliver thyroxine to our body cells and tissues. Okay, so I'd like to talk a minute with you about some thyroid gland disorders. We didn't talk about this in class on Tuesday. First off, let's break down the hormone disorders here, whether they are hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism. Let's break it into those two categories. What does it mean that we have hypothyroidism? Not enough, right. Okay, and of course, hyper is excess thyroid hormone, so that's an extreme, that's an excess level. So we've got three kinds of hypothyroidism listed here. We've got myxedema, we've got cretinism, or otherwise known as congenital hypothyroidism, and then finally we've got goiter. Goiter is listed in both locations. It's also listed as a hyperthyroid condition because the symptoms of goiter can fall into either category, which is kind of odd. For the hyperthyroidism conditions, we've got one called Graves' disease. Okay. So you can have hypothyroidism and not have myxedema. We think of these as being like extreme forms of hypo versus hyper conditions. I've got hypothyroidism, but I don't have myxedema. You know, thank goodness I'm not to that extreme level. But a lot of people can walk around with hypothyroidism and just be tired all the time and not realize that that's actually what's going on. So, you know, we're talking extreme conditions here with thyroid issues. Let's see, on your worksheet, let's take myxedema first. And this is in the little chart there on page 9. So if a person has severe untreated hypothyroidism, it's classified as myxedema, and this is an adulthood issue. You'll notice that in this case, we see all sorts of issues such as hair loss, dry skin, and this is a big one, fatigue and can't think clearly. If you've ever been so sick that you can't get out of the bed and every move that you make is painful, that's what myxedema is like. It is bone-numbing exhaustion, and every move that you make requires effort. The other issue of not being able to think clearly comes from not having enough thyroxine. So it's kind of like being drunk without the benefits of being drunk, right? Okay, so there's none of the la-la fun feeling that may come from alcohol. It's just feeling like you woke up in the middle of the night in a fog all the time. So that is unfortunate and points right back at being a thyroxine issue. So slow heart rate, weight gain, we oftentimes see those things come first, and then we see the other issues like the fatigue and the mental fog. There is a way to fix this if the person's body is receptive to it. What kind of medication would you administer here? Thyroid hormone, exactly. Good. Give thyroid hormone. So oftentimes we administer thyroid hormone until the person feels better and the numbers line up like they should. I do want to mention from experience that if they test your thyroid hormone and they say, well, hey, your numbers look good, they're in the normal range, and if you're still feeling like this, get them to continue working on your numbers. You know, get them to tweak your medication because the numbers don't tell the entire story. There's a lot that's going on behind the scenes with conversions of these hormones, and even though the numbers may look okay on paper from a blood test, for TSH and T4 and T3, you may not feel very good. And likewise, we know that hormones are stored for about 30 days in what part of the thyroid gland?
Your coloid,
yeah. So there may be a time lag there in getting you to feel better, even though the numbers may actually look like you're feeling okay. So this one can be treatable if a person's body is receptive to taking thyroid hormone supplements, and they may have to tweak it until they can get it to work out okay. Part of the name of this disorder is edema, and you'll notice that edema is swelling, and especially in the face of these two patients. So you'll notice the puffiness around the eyes here on both of these. Especially him, it goes away after he's treated with thyroxine. So, you know, oftentimes we just look at somebody and we say, oh, you look tired, you look swollen, maybe you're just old, right? Sometimes we look at people and say, well, that's just what happens to the face when you age. But in fact, that may be the sign of myxedema. All right, so we've got another one here, another extreme case of hypothyroidism. But notice this one is a childhood issue. Its old name is cretinism. The more commonly used term nowadays is congenital hypothyroidism. Congenital meaning what?
At birth.
At birth, exactly. So we're looking at babies being born with this condition. In fact, it's such an important thing to diagnose that when babies are born, they do all sorts of poking and prodding. They test their blood the day of birth for thyroid levels. And if they're diagnosed with this, then they can start treatment the day of birth. So it's a very important issue that we don't want to have a child growing up with a congenital hypothyroid issue. And you say, well, why not? Well, you know, there's all sorts of things that can go on here. Underdeveloped body, poor development. I'm trying, again, very hard not to say the word growth, because this is not a growth hormone issue. This is a development issue. And also, development includes the nervous system. And so we may see mental retardation come with this development issue. So these are patients that grew up without adequate thyroxine levels. And you'll notice the body size is stunted. The facial development here is stunted. You'll notice this man caps out about 4 feet or so tall. This is a girl from a textbook in the 1950s. And at age 16, I think she looks like maybe 4 or 5 years old. She has not gone through puberty because she did not have adequate thyroxine levels. We don't know about her nervous system development and how it might have affected her brain. But we do know that after 2 years of treatment with thyroxine, she was able to go through puberty. So interesting what that thyroxine can do. I don't know if you guys saw on the news the story in California. Yeah, there was 13 kids, yeah.
Yeah, that was
yeah. They were ages 2 to 29. They were chained to furniture. When the 17-year-old escaped and was able to get help to come, the police came and got them all out. I believe they were in the hospital at this point getting nourishment because they were all malnourished. Mm-hmm. And they said that they thought the adults, there was, I think, 5 or 6 kids that were actually adult age, and they thought that they were children because of the malnourishment. So you can see that malnourishment can also lead to these kinds of effects like what you see here with cretinism. Yeah, it's amazing stuff. You sure don't. And they said that neighbors didn't know what was going on and had no idea that that many kids were living there. So, yeah. Another case of congenital hypothyroidism is on the far left here. Just for comparison's sake, we talked about these two the other day. They have pituitary dwarfism, simply a lack of growth hormone during the childhood growing years. You'll notice that the pituitary dwarfs actually have childlike bodies, but with cretinism, it looks like the torso grew to a normal size, but the rest of the body didn't catch up. So it affects the body in a different way to have a thyroid issue than it does to have a growth hormone issue. So kind of just interesting to note there how those hormones play a role in growth and development of the body. Just for sake of conversation, these two people here have what's called a chondroplasia, and that is a growth plate disorder. So they probably had adequate growth hormone. They didn't have dwarfism in terms of not producing enough growth hormone. It's that their plates were not responsive to it. So the interesting thing is we could have given them growth hormone injections and they still would not have grown to their normal height. So the Little People Big World show on TLC, that's the kind of dwarfism that they have. Let's see, we've also got an issue here with goiter, and goiters can form due to lack of iodine in the diet, or perhaps a person's inability to metabolize that iodine and use it for thyroid hormones. So what the thyroid gland will do is, in either case, it will try to condense and concentrate iodine out of the bloodstream, and if it's having a difficult time doing that, it becomes enlarged. So if you enlarge the thyroid gland, what structure does it squeeze? Trachea. So what kind of symptoms might you have? Can't breathe, had difficulty breathing, you're right. Maybe even difficulty swallowing. So About 100 years ago or so, they started to realize, oh, there's a pattern to where people are having goiters. And in the United States, the area across the northern tier of the country around the Great Lakes, all of this is low iodine content in the soil. Normally, you hear that seafood is a great source of iodine, but they found that even fish caught in the Great Lakes was low in iodine levels. So, you know, the old recommendation of eating fish apparently didn't really work there very well. So, you know, about 100 years ago, they said, okay, let's start iodizing salt. You know, in the grocery store, you can purchase iodized versus non-iodized salt. Why might somebody want to avoid purchasing iodized salt? They're hyperthyroid, exactly. Yeah, so we do want to sell both kinds of salt for those conditions. So if you don't, of course, have an iodine issue, then iodized salt may be fine for you in order to supplement whatever you may not be getting from other foods. So nowadays we know that iodine is probably the underlying issue for goiter. And for treatment, we can either add iodine back to the diet. We can also treat with synthetic hormones such as synthroid or unithroid or levothyroxine. Ultimately, if the thyroid gland is not responsive, then we may have to do one of these things here. Use a radioactive iodine pill to kill the thyroid tissue. And then if that doesn't work, then surgery may be required to remove the thyroid gland. But, you know, that's kind of like the last resort, because if you take out the thyroid gland, then you run a risk also damaging calcium regulation. So we may not want to go to that point unless it's completely necessary. These are some cases of really extreme-looking goiters. This person here has a scar, probably had the goiter removed, but you can see that really begins to enlarge around the sides and the front of the thyroid gland. Okay, so let's swing to the opposite end here. Graves' disease is what we consider to be an extreme case of hyperthyroidism, and you'll notice there's a lot of symptoms here that kind of scream at you. One of them is this person's really hot and is burning up because the metabolic rate is running so fast. So people with hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease may be heat intolerant. So, you know, it gets summertime, it gets 90 degrees, you're like, oh, I can't stand it. They're taking their clothes off, they're fanning, they've got the air conditioning running as cold as it can go. Those are some things that people with Graves' disease might experience. Other things we may see: weight loss, muscle wasting, and tachycardia. What is that? Why do you think they have a fast heart rate? Metabolism. Good. Metabolism's running crazy. Heart rate speeds up.
What is muscle wasting?
The metabolism is burning so fast that you actually break down your muscle tissue for energy. So you end up burning your muscles for glucose.
Oh.
Yeah, and so they end up losing, they not only lose fat weight, but they lose muscle weight too. Yeah. So, I mean, that is not the preferred way to lose weight. Tammy.
Is that dangerous for a person that's young and pregnant?
It could, because it can wear out your heart. The tachycardia is certainly an issue. And then it just speeds up everything else. You know, so you're talking about your entire metabolic system is just running at a fast rate of speed. But the real dangerous issue they look at is that heart rate. Yeah. Okay, so with this condition, with this Graves' disease issue, there is another kind of a negative side effect that comes along with it. And I want you to take a look at the bulging eyes up there. Because the tissues in the body are being grown at such a fast rate of speed, there are connective tissues behind your eyes in the eye socket that can grow fast and push your eyes out of the eye socket. How crazy, right? So we end up seeing a condition like this. And unfortunately, the eyelids may not be able to close over the eyes, and the corneas dry out and become infected. And yeah, this is actually somebody local. Somebody's mother had this condition, and her eyes got infected, and they actually sewed her eyelids shut for a time period to give her eyes a rest. So, yeah, that's an unfortunate thing. It is not reversible, so once you've got exothalmos, it's a kind of just a condition you have to live with and work with. So, yeah. So with this issue, you kind of have the same type of treatment. They may do a radioactive iodine pill to stop some of that overactive thyroid hormone from being produced, kill some of that thyroid tissue, and if that doesn't work, then they may do surgery to remove the thyroid gland. All right. So, not funny, but if you have trouble remembering the conditions here, just keep in mind that Graves' disease will put you in the grave because of what it does to your heart. Okay, so it's running you so fast and wide open that ultimately it can wear out your heart. So this is not a condition that, this is not the way to go for weight loss, right? Because it will ultimately wear your heart out. Okay, so I think that takes you through the tour of thyroid issues there. How about questions or anything I can clarify for you?
So if you were to get the thyroid taken out, okay, do you need the thyroid hormone and it would mess with your calcium?
It could potentially mess with your calcium, yeah.
So you would have to take, what would they prescribe for that?
Maybe a calcium supplement. It depends on what the problem, where your regulation issue is.
Right.
But yeah, if they take out the parathyroid glands, when they take out the thyroid gland, they're not supposed to, but I think it's apparently hard to tease them apart, then yeah, you're looking at some kind of thyroid supplement.
So that should be the last option?
That's what it seems to be, because they'll try to do manipulations with hormone supplements. They'll try to do hormone supplements after they do this, and if that doesn't get a person regulated, then they'll surgically remove.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, and the only way they would give those hormone supplements if you're overactive is if they have given you the radioactive iodine pill or surgically removed, and then now you've yo-yoed to the other end, and then they're going to bring you back up. But yeah, that you're right. They would not give those unless they have. From my understanding, I think what they'll do is if they can't get you, you know, if they test you and you've got an extremely fast basal metabolic rate, a TSH level is really close to zero, then I understand that they'll do this with the radioactive iodine.
So there's no inhibiting hormone replacement that they can do to decrease?
Not that I know of. Yeah, because if that tissue is just on its, if it's on its fast speed where it's just hypersecreting hormones, there seems to not be a way to slow it down. Yeah. Which is unfortunate. And I can't imagine what life might have been for somebody before this kind of stuff came along. Okay, so calcitonin is our next one. It's at the bottom of your page. And this one is just a total different set of hormone in terms of what it does from your thyroid hormones. So calcitonin is one that helps to regulate blood calcium levels, and because it regulates blood calcium levels, it operates under humoral control. You'll notice it's produced by parafollicle cells. We don't store this one, it's made on demand. And we tend to think that this one is more active in kids than it is in adults, because it tends to cause osteoblasts to become activated, and we store the excess calcium from the bloodstream to the bones. So, of course, kids are growing. Their body skeletons are being built. We tend to see this one being a less active hormone once we reach adulthood. Okay, so calcitonin lowers blood calcium levels. It activates osteoblasts. It makes bones grow. Okay, so it removes the extra calcium from your bloodstream. So, excess blood calcium can be a bad thing. Excess blood calcium can give you muscle cramps. It can make your heart work overtime. It can make your heart pump really hard. So that's why we want calcitonin to remove the excess calcium out of your bloodstream and deposit it to the bones. Thinking back to Bio-210, why is calcium important for muscles? Helps them contract, yeah. So it allows for troponin and tropomyosin and actin, all that stuff, to work properly, yeah. So without calcium, your muscle contraction would be weaker, but we certainly don't want extra because then your muscle contractions are stronger. So we want to use calcitonin to remove that excess calcium. Kind of along the same conversation here is parathyroid, and that's going to flip us over to page 10. So we've talked about these little glands. They're on the back side of the thyroid gland. There's about 4 to 8 nodules of tissue here. And the only hormone produced by the parathyroid glands is the parathyroid hormone. So thankfully something easy, right? Okay, so parathyroid hormone is the only one produced by the parathyroid glands. And you're welcome to call it PTH for short. Sometimes they call it parathormone. It's a weird one. PTH may just be easier to remember. This one also regulates blood calcium levels, but it is an antagonist to calcitonin, meaning what? Works against, yeah. So if calcitonin lowers blood calcium, PTH raises blood calcium. Good. It, too, is under humoral control, meaning that blood calcium levels will encourage the parathyroid gland to release the hormone if needed. Research has shown that in an adult, this is the hormone that mainly controls your blood calcium levels. So it tends to be the more dominant one once you reach your adulthood years and have stopped growing. Just some interesting things for thought. There's an old saying that goes, for every child, a tooth is lost. And you may know somebody or may experience yourself cavities during pregnancy, cavities during breastfeeding, maybe tooth falling out during pregnancy or breastfeeding. So women oftentimes have teeth issues when they're pregnant or breastfeeding. So what is the body stealing away from those teeth?
Calcium.
Good. Using which hormone?
PTH.
Yep. So they say that even a woman who is breastfeeding who takes calcium supplements can't keep up with the leaching of calcium from her body, that it takes stopping breastfeeding before her body can rebuild the adequate level of skeleton that she was being robbed of during breastfeeding. So, yeah, pretty impressive. So once you stop breastfeeding, the body eventually deposits back enough of that calcium. We already talked about this. The hormone that antagonizes PTH is calcitonin. So interesting, they're both coming from the same neighborhood here in the neck. I do also want to mention that if you do need blood calcium, calcium is really important for muscles to contract. You can not only get calcium from your bones, but you can also pull it from the kidneys. When you make urine, there is some calcium that can be removed from your body into the urine. So if you want to keep that calcium, you can reclaim it back into the bloodstream from that forming urine. And likewise, foods that you eat may have calcium in them, and you can also reclaim that calcium from your intestines. So there is more than just one source of calcium floating through your body. We can get it from the digestive system and the urinary system as well. I did want to point this out to you because if somebody has a parathyroid condition called hyperparathyroidism, then we may see problems affecting these three locations, bones, kidneys, and intestines. So what does parathyroid hormone do to your blood calcium levels? Increases it, right. And if you're hyperparathyroid, then your blood calcium levels just are going to be really high, right? So what do you think happens to your bones when you've got really active parathyroid hormone?
Become brittle.
Good. What do you think we develop in our kidneys when we've got overactive PTH?
Kidney stones.
And what do you think your intestines feel like? Crampy. Yeah. Yep. So you may be crampy with that stuff. In fact, there's an old saying here, stones, bones, groans, and moans can come from hyperparathyroidism. Yeah. So it does not sound like a very pleasant condition to experience. So ultimately, if we've got excess calcium in the bloodstream and we look at these kind of symptoms, then we point the finger back at the parathyroid hormone being too active and raising that blood calcium. All right, so I think you got your blink there at the bottom of the page. Okay, any questions on that page?
Yes. Yeah, I'm a little lost. Okay. How does, calcium, how does it make it, if you have too much of it, the bones brittle?
It's just, it's leaching calcium out of your bones and putting that calcium in your bloodstream.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like osteoporosis, but it's not osteo, it's...
You still have it, but it's just not where it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah, the calcium's in the blood instead of in the bones for storage, yeah. All right. Let's see, if we head on over to our next topic, that's going to be page 12. We have the adrenal glands. Each kidney has an adrenal gland sitting on top. Each adrenal gland has two portions, an outer cortex and an inner medulla or medulla region. And they are different in their tissues. The outermost cortex is made up of endocrine gland tissue. Once again, this is epithelial tissue. And the innermost medulla is actually nervous tissue. This story, this conversation should sound a little familiar. What other part of the body have we talked about that's kind of made this way? Yeah, pituitary. So we're kind of looking at the same setup here. So I just want to repeat that when we talked about ACTH, and CRH, we're specifically talking about hormone release from the cortex, that outermost region. We were not talking about the medulla, which is the nervous tissue inside. So just want to clarify that there's a difference there in those two tissue types. The adrenal cortex actually is layered, kind of like a layer cake, and the layers are called zonas. We've got three zones that make three different kinds of hormones in the adrenal cortex. The outermost one is called zona glomerulosa. I don't know what person named these awful things. Okay? The fasciculata, sounds Italian, right?
Pasta.
I will have the fasciculata today. And the reticularis is the deepest of our three layers. And you'll notice that the hormone classes produced by each layer has corticoid as part of its name. What does that tell you, corticoid?
Steroid.
Good. And you may also assume that corticoid probably means adrenal cortex. Okay, so you've got two great clues there. You're right, corticoid means steroid hormone. And another great clue is that corticoid most likely tells you it's the adrenal cortex. You'll notice the classes of hormones are generally named here. We've got mineral corticoids, glucocorticoids, and gonadocorticoids. That tells me what's being regulated in the body. For instance, a mineral corticoid is going to regulate minerals in the bloodstream. That makes me think of rocks and boulders floating, you know? It's not. It's things like sodium and potassium that are being distributed throughout the bloodstream. We've got glucocorticoids. Those hormones regulate glucose. Okay, and then gonadocorticoids, alternately sex hormones, regulate the gonads. Those are things like estrogen, testosterone. They're mostly hormones that we call androgens.
Sorry. I gotta find it so I can turn it off. I'm on those.
Just got scared there for a minute. I was like,
sorry.
What is the sound coming from it?
Horses.
Oh. You got my adrenal medulla working. Okay, so here you can see the three layers, the zones, you know, you've got the outermost, middle, inner layers there, and then the medulla down here, the deepest of those tissues at the very inside portion of your adrenal cortex. Kind of a funny here for you to keep straight. what is being regulated by your adrenal glands. The adrenal glands do regulate salt in the bloodstream. They regulate sugar in the bloodstream. And to a very small extent, they have an influence over your sex organs. So that's kind of the basic thing that we're looking at with the adrenal cortex, not the medulla, with the cortex. I love the teddy bears. PG teddy bears, right? Okay, so I'm going to introduce you to one of your new best friends for the semester. This one is called aldosterone, and it is classified as a mineral corticoid. First off, let's just look at the terms here. Because it's a mineral corticoid, corticoid, you told me, is a steroid hormone, and we're going to assume it comes from the adrenal cortex. The prefix mineral tells me that we're probably regulating salt in the bloodstream. And by salt, what I mean is sodium and potassium. Okay, something else you can look at, aldosterone has an O-N-E ending. And we've talked a lot about endings through Bio-210 and 211. This ending here tells me I'm a steroid. Okay, so you've probably heard of testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. There's those similar endings. So yeah, aldosterone happens to be a steroid hormone. Kind of interesting that aldosterone is produced by your adrenal glands, and it travels right next door to target your kidneys. So talk about convenient location for this hormone. It is going to go right into your kidneys and regulate sodium and water balance in the bloodstream. So the way that you can maintain blood, sodium, and water balance is by influencing what you lose in your urine. You know, urine is just waste. It doesn't matter if it has a little bit of salt or a lot of salt, a little bit of water or a lot of water. What matters is you've got the right amount of salt and water balanced in your bloodstream. So what your body does is it says, okay, hey, here's extra, dump it in the pee, get rid of it. Or, you know, we need to keep all we can, put as very little in the urine as you possibly can. So like I mentioned, you know, urine is just waste product. We're going to regulate the bloodstream and then remove any excess to the urine. So kind of what we're thinking about here is how sodium and water influence your blood pressure. Thinking back to what you learned about osmosis, what is the relationship between salt and water? That's it. Water follows the salt. Yep. So the more salt you've got, the more water you retain, right? And here's something we haven't yet learned, but we'll go ahead and talk about it. The more water you've got in your bloodstream, the higher your blood pressure goes. Okay? So the more salt you've got, the more water you're going to keep, the higher that blood pressure goes. If you're dehydrated and you don't have a whole lot of water in your bloodstream, what happens to your blood pressure? Drops, it decreases, right? So just something we'll tuck in the back of our heads and keep. We know that blood pressure is dependent on how much water you're circulating in your bloodstream. If you need more water, you can do so by reclaiming salt, which will encourage water reabsorption from your kidneys, and that will in turn increase your blood pressure. So that's just something we're going to kind of hang on to here, is this relationship between salt and water, and know that aldosterone is deriving salt reabsorption from the urine form that's being formed by your kidneys. Now, thinking back, in Bio-210, you may have talked about a sodium-potassium pump. Where was that pump used? Yeah, in your cells, and especially in muscle cells and nerve cells, right? Okay. Do you remember the exchange rate?
3 to 2,
that's it. So you would keep 3 sodiums, 2 potassiums, that's it. So aldosterone actually turns on the pump, and of course you exchange 3 sodiums for 2 potassiums. What that means is if aldosterone is present in your kidneys, it says to your kidneys, hey, give me 3 sodiums, don't let them go in the urine. And in exchange, dump out these 2 potassiums into the urine. Okay? So we're not keeping them at the same time or dumping them at the same time. It's an exchange here that's going on. So if you need the sodium, you keep three, and in exchange for keeping three, you dump and get rid of two potassiums. Okay? So in which direction will water follow, the sodium or the potassium?
Sodium.
It comes where the sodium comes, right? Good. So this kind of takes us back full circle. We already talked about a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. What does it make your kidneys reclaim?
Water.
Water, right. Does ADH also make you keep salt? Just water. Yeah, so it does not influence salt or sodium reabsorption. ADH just makes you keep salt, just water, and just no salt there. So when aldosterone is making you keep the sodium, ADH is saying, hey, water, come back too. So those two things work together. So we know that water follows salt, and that's how it's going to happen in your kidneys, is sodium and water get reclaimed simultaneously. Does that make sense? They are a tag team. Exactly.
So would that be the permissiveness and the
synergist? There is a permissiveness take to it, yes, and they are synergist, because ultimately their goal is to both increase blood pressure.
Yep.
Good.
Is there ever going to be a time that you're going to use aldosterone without ADH, or is it always going to be
that? There probably is a time where you could use one and not the other. I do know that you may use ADH and not aldosterone if you're too salty, but if you're not salty enough, then you're most likely going to pull both of those, water and salt, back in. Yeah. Yeah. Salty.
Too salty.
You're too salty. Okay, so this is kind of a weirdo in terms of the hormone family. You know, we've talked about a pretty simple humoral or hormonal kind of stimulation so far for every hormone we've discussed, but this one's not that. Aldosterone is one of those hormones that actually can be humorally stimulated. It can be hormonally stimulated. Okay, so there's a little more complexity here with how aldosterone might be released and how it might be regulated. So let's take the first thing. We've got low blood pressure. So if you get up in the morning, you don't have a whole lot to eat or drink, maybe you're not feeling too good, then your body's going to help you maintain blood pressure simply by reclaiming sodium and water from the urine that should be formed. You may get up and pee, but you may not pee again for the rest of the day if you don't eat or drink. Okay? So what's happening to the fluids that should have been dumped into the urine? You're retaining it, right. So in the case of being dehydrated, you may have low blood pressure. And so aldosterone is keeping the sodium, and ADH is promoting that water reabsorption right alongside. If you have low blood pressure, you probably also have low blood volume, and again, aldosterone will be stimulated to keep the sodium in the water. Low blood sodium levels, we know, are tied hand in hand with low blood volume and low blood water content. So again, those three things just go hand in hand in causing you to reclaim more sodium and more water back into the bloodstream. So these first three things, they don't seem out of line, do they? They seem like they're three good friends that would go together. And then you've got this last one, high blood potassium, that kind of seems like an oddball. So high blood potassium levels may also encourage aldosterone's release. So when aldosterone is present, you keep three sodiums and you dump what? You dump two potassiums, right. So if you happen to have high blood potassium levels, that too will turn on aldosterone to start dumping potassium into the urine. What's important is that your blood potassium levels are in the right range. You know, so what if you dump excess into your urine? What matters is if you have the right level in your bloodstream. Do you know what can happen to your heart if you have high blood potassium levels? You can have a heart attack, exactly. So your heart can stop if you've got excess blood potassium. So that's why it's really, really critical for aldosterone to dump and get rid of that extra potassium. So some things like, medications like diuretics can alter the potassium level. Insulin injections can also alter your potassium level. So it's critical that your kidneys can dump and get rid of that potassium. So people with kidney disease certainly have to watch if they're taking those kinds of medications. Okay, so in terms of control, here we go. We've got humoral, we've got hormonal stimulation, and we've got this mechanism up here that all can regulate aldosterone's release. So on this list here, the number one most important mechanism for regulating aldosterone is the renin-angiotensin mechanism. Okay, and so that one should be down there near the bottom of your page, bottom of page 12. Sodium levels can also influence. We know potassium levels can. And then finally, ACTH down there can also play a role. But the number one influence on this list is the renin-angiotensin mechanism. It is the most important controller of aldosterone's release. So I'm just hanging out here in case you would like to copy this down. Everybody get the attendance roster? Okay.
So when we're asked the question, what hormone is released to help with stress, we would put aldosterone?
In terms of stress, I'd have to be more specific.
Okay.
Because if I'm talking stress and glucose regulation, it's cortisol. Or if I'm talking stress and blood pressure, I would go this route with aldosterone.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just kind of recap so far. What does aldosterone encourage your kidneys to keep?
Sodium,
right. And it's got a tag team buddy, ADH, that also tells your kidneys to keep
water.
Good. And if aldosterone is present, then your kidneys will dump or exchange what?
Potassium,
right. Good. So the potassium leaves in the urine. The sodium comes back into the bloodstream for you to keep. Good. Okay, so ultimately, if you're keeping sodium and water into the bloodstream, what happens to your blood pressure?
It increases.
It increases, good. So we're kind of getting a feel for how aldosterone is working. It makes you keep sodium. It works with ADH to help you keep water. It, of course, raises your blood pressure when it's active. So knowing that, we can now look at this list and see how we can stimulate aldosterone to be released. The first mechanism there, renin-angiotensin mechanism, is actually based on a blood pressure problem. So if you have low blood pressure, maybe you didn't feel like eating or drinking this morning, then your kidneys are actually monitoring your blood pressure. And when they detect the low blood pressure, they release a chemical called renin. So it's kind of like a cry for help. And renin then travels to your liver. Once at your liver, renin will then turn on the chemical called angiotensin. Why being a vasoconstrictor, why is that a helpful thing? Bingo, good. So if it's a vasoconstrictor, it squeezes the vessels, constricting them, and that raises the blood pressure. That's not a permanent solution, though, for the problem, because the problem may be the fact that we don't have enough water or sodium in our bloodstream. So just squeezing the vessels, it's kind of like a halfway there fix. It's not a solid fix. So we can come back full circle with angiotensin telling the adrenal glands to release aldosterone. And so, of course, that's going to make you retain sodium. We also release ADH through this mechanism, and that makes you retain more water. So this is kind of a silly conversation, because the conversation came from your kidneys to your liver to the adrenal glands back to the kidneys, right? Okay, so it's kind of like going outside, knocking on the window, and yelling a message back in the house. You know, this is kind of like the same kind of conversation. So from the kidneys to the liver to the adrenal glands back to the kidneys, we come with our full circle message. But nonetheless, this is the most common way for us to encourage aldosterone's release and help to increase blood pressure. So what is the stimulus for this mechanism?
Low blood pressure,
good. What organs pick up on the low blood pressure problem?
Kidneys.
Good. And the kidneys release a chemical called?
Renin.
Good. Now, the next organ to get the message is the
liver.
Okay, and the liver then now releases a chemical, angiotensin. That not only squeezes vessels, but it also comes back to the adrenals. And what do the adrenals now release?
Aldosterone.
Good. So it's just a message come full circle. Aldosterone tells the kidneys to reclaim sodium and dump
potassium.
Good. And if you keep the sodium, and of course water comes too, what happens to your blood pressure now?
Goes
back up. Good. So ultimately, this can help to fix a blood pressure problem. Now, we are not saying the obvious here, which is if you're thirsty and you're dehydrated, you're probably going to drink something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that can too help this issue, but in the absence of drinking or pulling in fluids through your mouth, this is a way for you to maintain blood pressure. You know when this is in effect because you may not go to the bathroom and pee very often, and if you do go and urinate, what color is it?
Yellow,
yeah, very small amount yellow urine, right. So when this mechanism is turned on, you're not going to pee very much. All right, so that's the number one most common way for us to regulate aldosterone. Sodium levels and potassium levels can also act as stimuli, so can ACTH. So let's just come back to ACTH for just a moment. So where is ACTH made?
Pituitary.
Okay. And it ultimately is made under the direction of?
Hypothalamus
and CRH, right. So we did it backwards, didn't we? Okay. So if you start at the top, hypothalamus can produce corticotropin releasing hormone. That tells your anterior pituitary to release ACTH. And now that tells your adrenal glands to release aldosterone. So if you are in fact stressed out, you know, we were talking about stress a minute ago, stress can actually encourage more CRH to be made and released from your hypothalamus, and that ultimately can tell your adrenal glands to make more aldosterone. If that is the case, where we turn on this mechanism through stress, then what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up, right. So you may have heard that under stress, people have high blood pressure, they gain weight, okay? So that is partly, we think, due to this process being turned on here. So, you know, they say take a break, take a vacation, take a breather, get off the merry-go-round, you know, let your body take a relaxing moment to restore normalcy. That helps to reduce corticotropic releasing hormone levels and interrupt this chain here. So what we want to do is put back in control the mechanism that should be controlling your blood pressure, the renin-angiotensin mechanism. Okay, so this one's a pretty tough one because it's got so many complex parts. Is there anything that I can help clarify or repeat here for you?
Ours. Okay, so one chart makes the blood pressure go up and the other chart makes the blood pressure go down?
In terms of these two, both actually make your blood pressure go up.
Okay.
Yep, so CRH, ACTH will increase aldosterone and blood pressure, and so will renin-angiotensin. Yep. How about other questions so far?
Okay.
This is one we probably can repeat. It's worth hearing again, so we may come back to this one too. I do want to tell you this one at the very bottom of your page. It's called ANP. So all this business about raising blood pressure, there must be something to lower your blood pressure. And there is. There's one hormone produced by your heart. ANP stands for atrial natriuretic peptide. I know that's a mouthful, but it tells you everything you need to know. Atrial means what? Yeah, heart. Good. What is natri? Yeah, sodium. Good. And what do uretics do? Make you pee, yeah, like a diuretic, right? Make release fluids. It's a peptide hormone, so that means it works by a secondary messenger system. Boy, this thing is packed with information. So it is released by your heart when your blood pressure is too high. What we don't want to have happen is your heart wall stretch and rupture and break. So that would be kind of bad, right? Okay, so if your heart walls are stretching too much due to high blood pressure, then ANP will be kicked in and released by your heart. It makes you lose more salt, more fat, and more water in your urine. So it reduces the load or the volume of fluid being circulated by your body. This one works as an antagonist to aldosterone, meaning what? Yeah, lowers blood pressure, lowers the blood volume, kicks out and get rid of your blood fluids in your blood, the salt in your blood. So where does all this stuff go? Urine. Yeah, goes out in your urine, exactly. So your heart actually can make you pee. Kind of a crazy thought, right? Okay, so just in the few minutes we have left, I want to introduce to you a little bit from page 13. We'll definitely come back and repeat page 13. So we're going to move to another zone in your kidney or your adrenal cortex. This one is a zone that produces glucocorticoids. And the one that we're going to focus on is called cortisone or cortisol. They pretty much do the same job. They are hormones that help to regulate blood glucose levels. Okay, and that's because they're glucocorticoids. Now, is cortisone a steroid hormone or a protein hormone? It's a steroid. Good. Cortisol is something that helps to regulate blood sugar over the long term. And it does this by a job called gluconeogenesis. And what gluconeogenesis means is that we are getting sugars from places that you normally don't think of them as being a sugar storage site. Normally, sugars are stored as more complex forms like starches. Okay, in our bodies, we store excess sugar as glycogen. All right, now, you can take sugar from a protein, which is not the normal method used, but we can still break down proteins and get sugar. And that's what gluconeogenesis is, taking fats and proteins, breaking them down, and turning them into sugar. This sound like a good deal to break down protein and turn it into sugar? Sounds pretty bad. Yeah. So if you want to lose weight, break down the fat and turn it into sugar, that's the way to go. But don't take the protein and break it down into sugar, because that takes lean muscle tissue and turns it into sugar. So, yeah, there's kind of a negative side here of what cortisol can do. But if you're not able to eat and you have to live, well, that's how we do it. We pull the sugar out of muscle tissue and fat tissue, and that promotes long-term normal sugar metabolism. Okay? So you got to get it from somewhere. I do want to mention that this hormone is anti-inflammatory, which means what? Works against your immune system, right? Okay, so if you have an inflammation, like if you have a really bad mosquito bite that won't stop itching, it looks all red and inflamed, you put hydrocortisone on, right? Anti-inflammatory. So In small doses, this is a good hormone for anti-inflammatory effects. In big doses, it can shut down your immune system. So that's what they use for people who have had organ transplants. They use these kinds of corticosteroids, and it will shut down your immune system, and then you catch everything that floats along.
Right.
Yeah, so this one's good in small doses. We need to come back and talk more about this one in class on Tuesday. So let's pick up here on page 13, and we'll finish up adrenals and pancreas on Tuesday. Ouch.